Marianne, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
There's a voter bill up for discussion at the legislature. Tell us about that, why you're following it, and basically what's happening with it.
Well, there's a number of voter bills. There's one in particular that was on a committee schedule for tomorrow and then just mysteriously today disappeared off that committee, which happens. Mm-hmm. You know, you follow along the bills and you try to track them as closely as possible, and especially if you have concerns over them. And they're supposed to let the public have a 24-hour notice. I mean, that's a requirement by law. So it has to be posted. So that means that tomorrow they couldn't put this back on the agenda. Now that they've taken it off, we're within the 24-hour period, they couldn't put it back at least for tomorrow. It could show up another time. But it was a bill. It's a bill by Representative Jake Anderegg. And his idea is that in order to register to vote, you would have to show proof of citizenship. And what he's saying, proof of citizenship, is essentially is a passport or a birth certificate. And there's a lot of concerns about this. First of all, when you vote, we already have a voter ID law. So when you go to vote, you have to show your ID, which typically most official forms of ID, especially our state ID forms or our state driver's license, already are proof of citizenship. Because we have gone several years ago through the identification change, you know, as we all changed our driver's license and they all changed the way they look, that whole transition that took about 4.5 years to do was actually to ensure that everyone with a state-issued driver's license or ID card was a citizen. So if you show your ID, you are a citizen.
So this bill wants to clarify even further by having you provide proof of citizenship. Is this kind of a solution looking for a problem?
Oh, it absolutely is. I mean, this is back to the whole voter fraud boogeyman. You know, we hear this every year. Every time there's a negative voting bill, it always comes back to this. Well, we can't have illegals voting. Well, we can't have people who aren't registered in the right district voting. We can't have these things. But yet we don't have any real instances of this occurring. You know, when you talk to the lieutenant governor's office, last year I had a conversation with him. I said, so, OK, let's just lay it on the table. How often does this really happen? And one of the representatives who I was talking to said, it doesn't happen. I'll tell you the two instances that it ever happens. Very seldom, occasionally, we catch a Mormon missionary mom who votes for her son who's on his mission. Well, the signature doesn't match. They catch it. They stop it. They make contact. They could actually charge her with voter fraud. Typically, there's not an intent to defraud. She's just thinking she's being helpful. The other is they've had a couple of instances where people have tried to prove voter fraud by committing voter fraud. Mm-hmm. So in other words, I'm going to prove that there's voter fraud, so I'm going to vote here. I'm going to drive down the street and I'm going to vote in another precinct. And then I'm going to take that vote, my proof of both of those votes, I'm going to march to the lieutenant governor's office and I'm going to say, see, there's voter fraud. And he said, what we get to do is we get to then charge them with voter fraud. Because it's a problem that doesn't exist, at least not that we can find any statistics to show.
I'm wondering then what the intent of the bill is. Is there you could read into this that there's a sort of hidden motive to the bill.
I think anytime you put a burden between a person's ability to engage in something as fundamental as voting, you're wanting to keep people from voting. I think you don't want the wrong people. And I don't know what those wrong people necessarily are for this representative, but I think you want the wrong people not to vote. I think you want to make it difficult. And I think you want to put things in place that just discourage activity, that discourage people from saying, well, that's a little bit hard. Gee, that's tough. And this has other ramifications. It not only with organizations like our organization registers people to vote, well, I'm not going to be able to certify whether or not their passport or their birth certificate is accurate. I'm not going to have a copier with me when I'm at an event. The League of Women Voters is a huge voter registration organization. I mean, this would be a burden they wouldn't be able to deal with. But then also you have a federal implication, which is where it gets really sticky. A couple of years ago, there was a case in Arizona that went to the Supreme Court. Well, the federal government has a federal registration benchmark. So under their guidelines, you sign an area on your federal registration. So if you didn't want to register in your state, you can still register federally. Mm-hmm. And it says, under perjury of law or under penalty of perjury of law, I am a citizen of the United States. So it's just a place that you sign. That's all they require. You don't have to prove it. You don't have to show anything. You just have to sign. But by signing so, that's a binding contract that you are saying that you are a citizen.
Essentially an affidavit.
Right. And the problem is, if you require more than that, you can only require it on state elections. So you could conceivably end up having to have two different kinds of elections. You could have a federal election and a state election for someone who was registered from the federal. Well, they couldn't vote for the state, so you'd have to have two different ballots. I mean, it's a mess. I mean, it is a can of worms. And the clerks have already started looking at this and saying, you know, this is a burden we can't handle. This could cost a couple of million dollars every time we have a federal election. It's just not realistic.
Was there a fiscal note attached to it? Do we know?
Well, there was a fiscal note, and it was unfortunately a little bit lower than the reality because the clerks didn't get their fiscal note in time. So there's a deadline to that. They'd sent all the information to the fiscal analyst, though, and everyone on the committee was prepared to pull out all of the information from the clerks to say, well, actually, this is the reality of this bill.
So Representative Andrig's bill was pulled from an agenda for a committee meeting tomorrow. Do you mean what's going to happen next, or when we'll see?
Well, we hear, and I actually talked to him just before I came here, and he said that what he's going to do is likely, rather than go this route, he's going to require a study or an audit. So it would actually be a thorough audit from the auditor's office to go through and find out if they can find any instance of this actually occurring. You know, if there's one or two people, it's not warranting a bill. If there's 4,000 or 5,000, yeah. And these are actually his numbers. He was using several thousand. It's a boogeyman. You know, this is not something that exists. So we're pretty comfortable that if it only goes to a study, it's not gonna find anything.
And it's something you will keep an eye on, though.
Absolutely.
So speaking of Representative Andrig, there was a bit of a Twitter flap up involving him today relating to a new bill. What was that all about?
Right. So Representative Kennedy has a bill, and we don't know if this will be heard or not. It's quite controversial, but it would essentially require a person to use a public restroom of their birth gender. So in other words, if you were born, your birth certificate, your original birth certificate said male, you would be required to use the men's restroom and the same for women. And this is targeted specifically at trans-identified citizens of Utah. And this is already an extremely, at-risk group of citizens. And so it's a really sensitive bill. It's going to have a lot of emotion to it if it does end up getting discussed in committee. So that comes back to the Twitter thing. There was a very offhanded remark on Twitter by Jake Andrig, who is a fellow representative of Representative Kennedy, and he commented that he was hoping that he could use that if he would just change his gender, perhaps he could use the women's restroom because it wasn't as crowded. I mean, that's not exactly the Twitter quote, but that was what he was inferring.
Because at the legislature, there are more men than women, and the men's restrooms might be busier.
Right. In fact, here's the Twitter quote. The private men's bathroom in the House office building is occupied, strongly considering a gender-identifying change to use the open women's.
Hmm. So meant as a joke, and then there was a response.
Right. And then there was a response by Senate President Wayne Niederhauser. First supporting SB 100, now switching your gender identity just can't keep up with you. You're a new man or woman.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I mean, it clearly insensitive, highly insensitive, and you know, very inappropriate. Not only appropriate from just a representative, but we also have the Senate President involved in this. The Senate President has said that it was a tweet by his intern, but you know, that bears other concerns too. I mean, I don't let anyone tweet for me. I mean, I think that's something that most people, you know, feel very, I mean, it's a comment that you make. And as the Senate President, especially, he should have a heightened awareness that anything that goes out on that Twitter is, I mean, we all watch it. Everyone watches the whole.
There's a hashtag.
Yeah, exactly.
UT leg.
Right, exactly. And so then Jake Andrig, it got some play, you know, and a few people posted it and said, really, this is quite an interesting exchange on Twitter, and this is really insensitive. And Jake Andrig posted that he apologized. He says, I sincerely apologize. My earlier comments regarding transgender issues was totally inappropriate. I own it, and I apologize.
Well, you know, so a flap up and whether or not there'll be, further repercussions, we're not certain.
Yeah, I mean, it's just insensitive. It's one of those things.
You know, and then finally today, as we heard earlier from a report from our own Ryan Cunningham here at KCPW, there was a kind of almost spontaneous wall of Post-its at the entrance to the Senate. What was that about?
Yeah, and we won't get into the whole bill. It's SB 100 again, which I'm sure will be talked about a ton. But I just think it was an interesting example of a great way for citizens to engage in a completely unique way. It's really creative. So outside the Senate chambers, big double doors, marble walls on the sides, all of these people who want SB 100 to be heard in a committee, put Post-it notes, put love notes, you know, put little notes, put big posters, all these things all over. So the wall is absolutely plastered with notes saying, senators, let's hear SB 100. So it's really creative. It's a clever way.
SB 100 being the non-discrimination bill that Senator Urquhart is presenting.
Correct.
Great. Marianne, thanks once again for coming in and filling us in on the daily doings at the state legislature.
Thank you.